In the 1850s, in Rome, they were doing some excavation work. And on one of the walls in Rome, they found some graffiti that was on the wall. Now, it might seem odd to you that I would post graffiti on a wall. But we went to see this when we went to Rome. I wanted to see this particular piece of graffiti because it's the earliest known pictorial blasphemy against Jesus. And I'll explain that as we go through this. This is somewhat a famous piece graffiti that's been discovered. Now, they'll date this anywhere between the first and third centuries. Wikipedia will put it at 200. And the more I searched around, I found it to be most people will place this around 200. I don't know when this was scribbled on the wall, but I want to explore this with you. Each time I do this, and I've done it maybe half a dozen times, my daughter-in-law says I go down the Google hole, Google rabbit hole, doing the investigating and looking, and that's probably what this was for me. But I learn more about this each time. This graffiti was discovered in 1857 in this building there at the Palatine Hill. I'll show you there. There's a picture I got from the net. And that's what they think it looked like in the first century. This is that pedagogium, the schoolhouse, where it was found. And evidently what they were doing is when they got to a point, because of these bigger buildings that are up on the ledge, they boxed this in to support what was behind these bigger buildings. And so when they did that, they encased, I meant to turn that on, they encased the wall for several, maybe 1,500 years. And then in 1857, when they opened it up, they found over 300 pieces of graffiti on the wall. Some of them said pedagogium exit, you know, so they knew it was this area. And scholars differ on exactly what rooms this was for. Something to do with the emperor, whether it was the places where soldiers were trained or the young men were trained. But that is what this is. 369 pieces of graffiti. And so one of these days, I won't go down the Google hole, but when I find a book that will tell me carefully of what they found, I want to get that book at some point, but so far I've not found what I'm looking for. When we were there, I took a picture across this Circus Maximus here. And you'll see that's the section where they found it. Of course, you go there today, this white building in the back is the museum. And so I go to Rome. I really want to look two things. The arch that you mentioned this morning, I wanted to see that in person because I've seen that picture a few times. And I wanted to see this graffiti that was on the wall in the museum. And you see my wife there looking at it because I missed it. I had to go and get to attend it. I had to find the attendant to find out where this was at because I read about it online. It's got to be here in the museum, right? Oh, yeah, it's over here. And she brings my wife in over here, and it's on the wall, no labels, nothing. And it's just blank. It's not very big. I wanted to see, to get a reference of what size it is. So Tammy is there in front of it. Against her will, she didn't want to be in the picture. And I took my phone, and I zoomed in, and now you can see the outline pretty carefully. Now, why is there a donkey's head on the cross? You're probably asking yourself that question. So this is the sketch when they sketched it out. because it's difficult to see clearly. This is an upsilon. This is a U. And it says, Alexamenos sabete theon. Alexamenos, worship God. That's a translation of this. Some will say, Alexamenos worships God. Now some will put his in there, but the his isn't actually in the Greek. It's supplied. But this young man is raising his hand toward the cross, and the boy who sketched this on the wall put a donkey's head on the cross. This is obviously a mocking Alexamenos as he worships Jesus. But this is the mock. Now, why the donkey's head? Well, before I had Josephus, I've had Josephus for a while, and I knew Josephus mentioned when he wrote against Apion, and Apion was saying, you Jews, you worship a golden donkey's head. And Josephus is saying, you know that's not true. When Pompey entered into Jerusalem and went into the temple, which he wasn't supposed to do, he said he found nothing. But there was a rumor going around. Do rumors go around? Now, I don't know why it keeps popping. Sorry. There's a rumor going around about the Jews worship a golden donkey's head. And Josephus says that is not true. And he explains that pretty thoroughly. In fact, in the Arch of Titus, in your class, you didn't see a donkey's head up there. You saw the menorah. You saw the table of showbread that was there, if you look at the outline. But you didn't see the Ark of the Covenant. That wasn't there either. But you don't see a donkey's head. They didn't find any donkey's head in the Holy of Holies. But that was the rumor since the days of, I guess, Antiochus Epiphanes, around 160 BC. But Josephus will mention the slur on the Jews of worshiping this golden donkey's head. And Tacitus, a Roman historian, a ruler, he records the same thing. And Plutarch makes mention of it also. I know my Google hole keeps going down. And a guy I never heard of is Fronto, who was an orator. We don't have Fronto's actual lesson, but somebody quotes him. And that's normally about when he died. And then Tertullian, which you may have known him, but he's a Christian there in Africa. He mentions also. So that's where I stopped, all right? That's enough. It's clearly understood. The slur against the Jews in the first two centuries A.D. is that they worshipped a donkey's head. Now you understand why he drew a donkey's head on top of the cross. I find this incredible. And if it's 200 AD, that's earlier than most of our manuscripts of the Bible. This is pretty. In fact, skeptics, atheists, they will have their say about Alexamenos here. But they can't refute him. It's there. It was found in Rome in the 1800s, 1850s. What astonishes me as I look at this is here's a man that's crucified, but he's called Theon. That's clearly seen down here. He's God, Theos, accusative there, Theon. It's connected to Judaism, obviously, because of the donkey's head. And Jesus was Jewish. The association between Christians and Jews early on were close. He's worshipped as God. And we know that from other Roman sources, that they would get early in the morning. They'd have the Lord's Supper sometimes, very early in the morning before the sun rose. And they sang hymns to Christ as to God. That's the Roman saying that. Pliny the Younger, I believe. He's obviously this Alexamenos, he's being mocked. It's a joke. It's a joke against some young man who's there trying, in service, being trained to be served the emperor, and he's being mocked. I thought, you know, maybe this Alexamenos is already pretty well familiar with the book of Romans, which have been written before this. Maybe his faith is strong. Maybe he can endure the mocking by others. So how do you interpret this? Just a cross. Someone dying on a cross. There's only one person who's ever lived from a cross. After crucifixion, Josephus talks about one guy. He had three friends. Two of them, even after they're crucified, they got him down. They died. But one of his friends actually lived after the cross. The only person that I know of. So here's a guy dying on the cross, and yet he's called God. Hey, that's... what do you do with that? What do you do with the crucifixion? How do you interpret the cross? Why did he have to die? And if I'm a follower of Jesus, what does that mean for me? How do I interpret the cross for my own life? There's some questions here. I'm not satisfied always with my answers. And what's the message? This morning, I want to walk through a little bit about the message of the cross and how Paul looked at it. Now, if you're here, I want to encourage you that when you come in, that you grab a bulletin. On the back of the bulletin, I'll have normally three questions. I have the reading. As I go through the questions, I'm going to try to answer the best I can the questions in the message for the second service. So I turn on the inside of that page, and you'll see the message of the cross. Now, how does the message of the cross, how does it apply and promote unity? So let's ask a question. How does the cross promote the idea of unity? Well, let me say, there is Corinth and there's Athens. And we're going to zoom in between Corinth and Athens in this picture. And there's Corinth, about 50 miles away. There's Athens. Now, Paul was told by Jesus in Acts chapter 18, I've got many people in the city. You continue to teach and preach. And Paul does. And he made the determination, think about this. If Jesus had told you in Murray, I have many people, keep on teaching and preaching, what would you preach? To attract people. What would you do? Paul was given, he just left Athens. Did things go well for Paul in Athens? Wow. That's the one place I would not want to follow Paul. But the gospel didn't have much effect in Athens. You read Acts 17. A few people became Christians, but not very many. Now he arrives at Corinth, and Jesus tells him personally, you keep on teaching and preaching. I've got a lot of people in the city. So what does Paul do? Well, if you've read 1 Corinthians chapter 2, Paul said, I determined. What did he? I determined to preach Christ and him crucified. If I'm going to draw people, it's going to be the cross that Alexamenos was also drawn to. Now, at Athens, you have the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. You have all kinds of philosophy being taught at Athens. You have great men following, and they have their disciples. And they have another great man, and they have his disciples. Another great man and his disciples. This idea of discipleship is not brand new with Jesus. It was in Athens for a long time. But they had a variety. You could choose to be an Epicurean or a Stoic or a certain kind of a Stoic. And Paul saw that. And Corinth saw that. Now the question is this. Should they take Christianity and make their own flavor? Should we be different? Isn't that the kind of the fad today, to be different? People like to be different. And so, how did Corinth, how did they they view being a Christian in a secular world. Well, it's interesting, the book itself, how often Paul encourages the church to be the same, to be united. And I go to 1 Corinthians, and I'm going to do a little drill here with me, so work with me here. Get your Bible out if you can. And if you're not, please listen carefully as I read it. In 1 Corinthians 1, verse 10, the first thing he hits is this problem of division. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1, 10, "Now I exhort you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all agree and there be no divisions among you, but that you be made complete in the same mind and in the same judgment." Now, isn't that a task or what? He's telling them to be of the same judgment, same mind. There's your stress of the sameness. In chapter 4 and verse 6, Paul says, "I've applied these things to myself and Apollos, that you may not go beyond that which is written." There you the idea of sameness. And then Paul says in chapter 4 and verse 17, "That's why I'm going to send Timothy to you, so he can tell you what." Paul says in 1 Corinthians 4, verse 17, "For this reason I have sent you Timothy, who is my beloved and faithful child in the Lord, and he will remind you of my ways, which are in Christ, just as I teach everywhere in every church." Now, you mean the idea, the sameness idea, doesn't just belong to them to be of the same mind at Corinth, but all churches? Timothy's going to tell you just what I've taught everywhere. He knows what I teach. He's going to teach you the same thing that I've taught everywhere. Does that mean all the churches were to be of the same mind? It sure seems to me. When he gets to chapter 7, and I've already had someone on the street here talk to me a little bit about divorce and remarriage. Did Paul teach the same thing everywhere he went on marriage, divorce, and remarriage? When I go to chapter 7, after he's been talking about marriage, I read verse 17, "Only as the Lord assigned to each one, as God has called each in this manner, let him walk," that last sentence, "just, and so I direct in all the churches." Now, wow. Corinth, you're to be a sin like everybody else. Well, I've taught you, I've taught everybody. Timothy's going to remind you of that. In chapter 11, verse 2, I know every time I mention the word tradition, for some people, they think, oh, you got to be against tradition. Well, no, hang on. I'm not against tradition. Verse 2 of 1 Corinthians, Paul says, "Now I praise you." Now here's the apostle praising a church. "Now I praise you because you remember me in everything and hold firmly to the traditions just as I deliver them." Oh, so it's all right to hold on a tradition that the apostle set up. Yes, it's the human tradition that gets sometimes pushed on to apostle tradition. No, we don't want the human tradition. But I do want to hold on clearly to Paul's tradition that he set up at Corinth. He was there for a year and a half. You set up a tradition in a year and a half? Can you do that? Sure you can. You got a year and a half. He set up a tradition. And Paul says, "I'm glad you're going to..." But when he went over in that same chapter down to verse 17, he says, "Oh, now I'm not going to praise you. This is where you messed up." What did they mess up on? The Lord's Supper. 11 verse 17. "But in giving this instruction, I do not praise you." Because you come together for the worse, not the better. And then in verse 23, he says something that my boss used to say to me too many times. And I was in a machine shop, and he would tell me how to make a part on a lathe or a mill, and I thought I got the idea down. You would do this in one operation, do this two operations. So I'm following the blueprint. I'm following how he kind of showed it to me. And I'm doing the best I can. But, you know, I made a mistake. And Rick, he would see what I was doing. He said, come here, Dan, for a minute. And he sit me down. He said, let me tell you this again. You know, when the boss tells you, let me tell you this again, you know you're in trouble. I didn't get it the first time, and I don't sometimes. And I don't expect you to get it either the first time. The Corinthians had it for a year and a half, and they weren't holding on to what Paul had taught as a tradition. And so what does he say? Verse 23, for I received from the Lord that which I also delivered to you. Now, wait a minute. You catch that? Paul's not saying of his own will. He said, I got this from Jesus. I got this from the Lord, and I gave it to you. Now, it's past tense. What I received, that's previous, I've already delivered to you. He's telling them again. And you read verse 23 down to verse 26, and you know what? You'll read the same thing in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, how he set the Lord's Supper up. And that's exactly what we do. In other words, Corinthians, the way you're doing the Lord's Supper, don't be different. Follow what I set up. That's what he wanted. In 1434, oh, it's a hot button here today. It's a hot button about every place I go. People don't want to listen to this, and I know that, but I'm just going to read it. In 1 Corinthians 14, verse 34, women are to keep silent in the churches. Stop for a minute. Is that just at Corinth? Is it just their custom? Or is this across the board everywhere? It's everywhere. Because what Paul taught at Corinth, he taught everywhere he went. Don't be different. We'll talk more about that later. And then 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2. What will he say? 1 Corinthians 16, verse 1. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also. What's he saying? The churches of Galatia are doing the same thing you're doing. And that's why I kept the map up here the way I do, because I want to be able to include with my mouse here. There's Antioch. That's Antioch of Pisidia, Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe. And you read Acts 13 and 14. Those four congregations were started by Paul, the churches of Galatia. And what are they doing on the first day of every week? They're laid by an ashore. And Corinth, don't be different. Be the same thing. Of all the letters, when I read 1 Corinthians, it shocks me sometimes how repetitive Paul was. Be the same mind. Timothy is going to teach you the very same thing I taught you. Marriage, divorce, and remarriage. All the churches believe what, because this is what I've taught. The Lord's Supper. This is what you do. And he goes through it and it's all clear. In fact, let me go cross out, be different. They're to follow through with it. Do you realize this one letter tells them to do the exactly same thing that we did here this morning? When I went to Romania, I stressed this a great deal. When they got together, they sang. Chapter 14, verse 15. In 14, 26, each one has a psalm, has a teaching, has a singing. They had a prayer. You pray in the spirit, you pray in the mind also. They gave. We just read that in 16. They had the Lord's Supper in chapter 11. And then the preaching, each one has a psalm, has a message. There's your preach. Guess what? This morning, we're following what the Apostle Paul said for the Corinthians to do. We're doing the exact same thing. We're trying to be a New Testament church as close as we can. But let's apply New Testament zeal and love and faith. Encouraged to speak up like Alexamenos, who seems to be unashamed in worshiping a crucified man. Now, I spelled it out pretty clearly there. But my question was this. How does the cross itself promote unity? And this is probably what I've not done very well. So go back with me if you will. Chapter 1. And start has Paul answered the problem of division at Corinth. And you know what it says in verse 11 and 12. Some are calling themselves of Paul, of Apollos, of Cephas, which is Peter, and of Christ. Yes, you can use the word Christ in a denominational way. You can use the word, the phrase Church of Christ in a denominational way, which we shouldn't. I'm just as much a Church of God preacher as I'm a Church of Christ preacher. I'm just as much as a Church of the Firstborn Ones, the book of Hebrews, as I am Church of Christ. I'm just as much a Church of the Living God. These are all phrases to describe the same group of people. And you can even use the term Christ in a denominational way if you're trying to exclude any other disciple of Jesus. And they were. And then Paul says this in verse 13. This is where I missed part of this. Has Christ been divided? And what the answer is, no, he's not been divided. You guys, some of you run, some of you listen to radio on a Bluetooth speaker. You know, you got to sync them, right? I think about this when I get done running. I got to sync my Garmin watch with my phone so I keep my mileage. And so I like that syncing part. We have to Bluetooth into Christ. I've got to sync with Him and with the cross itself. I've got to be able to apply the cross to me. There's one Christ. There's only one crucified. In verse 13, has Christ been divided? No. Paul was not crucified for you, was he? No. When you look at the cross, you look at somebody who loved you enough to take your place. He was spit upon. You ever been spit upon? I've been spit upon. It's not very nice. You've been slapped? I've been slapped. They beat his back. Then he hung on a cross from about 9 o'clock in the morning to about 3 o'clock in the afternoon in agony. And he took my place. So who should I be loyal to? Above everybody else, above my wife, above this church, above my family, above everybody else, who am I to be loyal to? The one who died for me. You know, as a preacher, I encourage people to put God first, Christ first. But you know what I'm doing when I say that? I'm just trying to repeat what He's done for you. Has it hit you? Did God put you before His own Son? Has God put you before Jesus? When I see Him on the cross, knowing that's my spot to pay for my own sins, I realize, for at least momentarily, He put me before His own Son. How can I not be? My allegiance is to Him. And Paul says, you're putting your allegiance to Paul or Apollos or Cephas and all this division? No, only one person has been crucified for you. And you and I need to honor Him first and try to do so in a way that honors Him. There's only one name you're baptized into. Paul says, you weren't baptized in my name. And you look at John 4, Jesus wasn't even baptizing people because, well, obviously, he doesn't want people going around saying, Jesus baptized. And I was in Romania, guess what? I tried not to baptize. You know why? I didn't want any Romanian thinking some American baptized. And mine. I didn't want to do that. And Paul, he made sure that he wasn't going around. He got other people to baptize, but he did baptize a few. And there's only one baptism. So how does the cross promote unity? You see the oneness up there. That's the way he wants us to be, is to be one. How does the message of the cross show the wisdom of God? I find this to be very interesting what God's done. When you read in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 17, listen to what Paul says. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in cleverness of speech. Do we like clever speakers? Funny speakers? Do we like you? People will pay good money for a clever speech from some CEO or from some comedian. Paul says, I wasn't about that. I'm not going to preach in cleverness. So that the cross of Christ would not be made void. You void the cross if you call for something else. Paul says, I'm not going to do that. And then he says, for the word of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, here's a quote, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the cleverness of the clever I will set aside. What is God doing with the cross? You know what? The guy who scribbled on the wall with that graffiti, he thought the crucified man being God was one of the foolish things he ever... Alexamenos, you worship your God. It looks foolish to the world. What has God done? Those people who think they're so smart and so wise, he's set them aside. And I'll go for the hearts who have a heart for my son. That's who I'll reach out to. He set aside the cleverness of the clever. That's what God has done. So the cleverness of speech, I'm not going to use. I'm going to bypass human wisdom. I'm not going to dazzle you with signs. It's going to look foolish. Verse 23. Last question. What kind of person is attracted to the message of the cross? Can you ask that question with me? What did God design? How did God design the cross and the message of the cross to reach the person he wanted to reach? Well, those, when they looked at Jesus on the cross, paying for our sins, they saw in it the power of God. Those who do not need dazzling signs, miracles, and wonders. Misfits, sorry if that insults you. Doesn't insult me. I'm a misfit. You know the misfit toys? The land of the misfit toys? That's me. Really, we're broken people. There's not many wise, not many smart, not many noble. But God has chosen the weak things. Am I weak? God has chosen the weak things to nullify those who think they're strong. And the despised, the people who are hurting, God chose them. Because they can see in the cross the difficulty of this life, the sinfulness of their own soul, and they look for Jesus for redemption and hope and life. The one thing I didn't get to see at Rome that I wanted to see. They say, and I can't confirm this because I don't have the book, but they say on another wall besides Alexamenos, it's written, this time in Latin, Alexamenos Fidelis. Alexamenos Faithful. I love that. I love thinking of a young man who's going to be true to Jesus, is going to be mocked, but he's not going to give up. And somebody scribbled on the wall, not too far from the crucified donkey's head, that Alexamenos Fidelis, faithful. Don't you want to die that way? I want to die, maybe foolish, but I want to die being faithful and true to the very one who died for me. Today, you may be here this morning, and you may believe in Jesus. You may need to have more evidence. Please come see me. I've got a lot more to share. You may be realizing you need help, and you want the salvation of your souls. If you believe in Jesus, you're willing to turn your life over to him, to follow what he said, and learn from the Master yourself. Be baptized to have your sins forgiven and begin your life with him as a Christian. We bid you to come while we stand and while we sing.